Ari Rosenbaum here with another fun-filled episode of the 4K Podcast. I think we're up to episode 288. 300 is going to be here sooner than later. But of course, this week's topic, we're going to talk about beware of the dark side of the 401k plan business. Stuff that still occurs to this day, stuff in the past that plan sponsors surely be on the lookout for. Of course, first things first, that401ksite.com. Further information on all our live events, Arlington, Texas, May the 3rd, Yankee Stadium, June the 7th. Two great days. We got guests lined up for both days. Dave Valley is a former Ranger and current Rangers broadcaster. He'll be there on May the 3rd. And on June 7th, we will have 1996 World Series hero Jim Leyritz. Yankees, Jim, Larry always gives me a list of guests, and Jim's name popped up. And, I'm a kid from the 70s and 80s, so I have more of a love of the team from the 70s, Reggie, Guidry, Goose Gossage. Obviously, we had Goose Gossage as a guest at that Disney event right before the pandemic. But I know that people have a great love of the Yankees from the 90s. Obviously, winning five World Series will do that as opposed to two in the 70s. So looking forward to those events. Go to that401ksite.com for further information on all our live events. We'll have a couple of tickets for the Yankee-Dodger game. If people are interested, they'll reach out to me and see what we can do for that. But let's go to the topic at hand. I grew up in New York City, obviously 70s, 80s, until 97. It's funny, I kind of lived more than half my life now here in Long Island, and I still consider myself a city kid. There's certain things out here in Long Island that just still to this day don't make any sense. I still don't understand why if you have a perfectly good sidewalk, people have to walk in the streets. It just doesn't make any sense. The driving here is worse than anything you ever see in the city, because in the city, you at least contemplate there'll be traffic. I mean, here in where I live, the four-way stop is kind of optional. Stop signs are kind of optional. Just had to, you can't go a drive in my neighborhood without coming to some sort of close encounters with a collision. But back in the 70s and 80s, people talk about, how unsafe New York City is now. People forget that before Giuliani and the Bloomberg days, New York City was terrible in terms of violence, stuff breaking down. Back in the John Lindsay era, they called it Fun City. And it wasn't fun because it was fun because of the violence and craziness that was going around. As a kid, I remember... I think it was 9 years old, maybe not even nine, and parents took us into the city, and we took a bus ride around Times Square, and there was like a porno theater every 100 feet, and at that time, New York City had to get buses from Washington, D.C., because we had these buses made by Grumman, which was this great Long Island defense contractor and bus manufacturer, and the buses couldn't withstand the New York City potholes and they fell apart. New York City in those days was kind of like how Gotham was in the Batman movies and comics and all that kind of stuff. And there was a dark side to it. And there's a dark side to the retirement plan business, the 401k plan business that I kind of fought years ago and kind of still around today. I mean, to me, revenue sharing is still a thing. The alphabet soup of share classes, that's still a thing. Now, I always said that revenue sharing to me was like payola. And what was payola? It was a scandal in the 50s when there was an illegal practice where the record companies would, pay the DJs for broadcast of recordings on commercial radio. Congress made payola a crime in the music industry. You can't do that. It was pay to play. And in my opinion, that was no different than the revenue sharing wars of that was kind of phased out thanks to fee disclosure. But, you know, to me it was payola because certain funds paid it. You know, they made a payment, that whole sub-TA fee. The idea behind it is that an actively managed fund, if the fund company isn't doing the record keeping, someone else will. So let's throw them a bone and give them some shekels to do that work. And I always said that revenue sharing was only legal because Congress didn't make it illegal. You know, the concerns over that practice have pretty much ended it. It's still around, not very, very popular. And the reason why it's not around or popular anymore is because of the fee disclosure regulations. There was a practice where TPAs would tell the client, I'm moving you over from one platform within your custodian to a revenue sharing paying platform. I'm switching out the funds. I'm going to use revenue sharing funds. I'm not telling you that they're revenue sharing. And I'm going to make more money on the plan. I'm going to give you a cut in fees. You're going to think, wow, it's a great benefit. But I'm making more money through the rev share. And, you know, the biggest problem to me was when I started this business, you were told that, you know, ETFs and Vanguard mutual fund, Vanguard index funds or any type of index funds, it would cost the plan to be more expensive to run because nobody ever factored in when it came to pricing. Nobody ever factored in the expense ratio of the underlying mutual funds in the plan. And, you know, obviously with a lot of the Tibble case and some other cases, litigation pretty, was it ABB, whatever it was. There were some landmark cases dealing with revenue sharing and really put much a stop to it. You know, to me, use of revenue sharing funds, you know, it's obviously not illegal. It just doesn't look right. You know, I when I worked for this TPA, this producing TPA, they were very well known for switching funds out, pocketing the rev share, not disclosing it. Obviously, fee disclosure changed that. And there was this guy at work. I'm not going to name his name because he still works at the successor to the TPA I used to work at. And he's one of those guys that I've made suggestions that some people who are there forever aren't really there because they're any good. They're there because they can't get a job somewhere else. And he was one of those guys. And when I said to him in, I think, 2007 or something like that, he thought I was crazy when I said that revenue sharing would be a thing of the past. He was laughing. Thought I was crazy. And, you know, obviously, history has really backed me up. Share classes is another kind of dark secret. There are too many plans out there. You know, to me, the whole share class thing is like alphabet soup. To me, there should be only two rev share classes, in my opinion. One is investor size, and one is the Admiral. I use the Vanguard shares, but the institutional Admiral share class. To me, having a special share class and different kind of share classes for retirement plans, it's just confusing. There are too many plans out there that probably are not still to this day are using an improper share class. That's obviously a liability concern if the plan's big enough. And, you know, this is still an issue. Not as much as it was, you know, prior to 2012, which again, you know, people like me, people like James Holland back in 2010, we were the guys saying, listen, this is going to end. And this is putting plan sponsors in, you know, liability issues. And we were told that we were making this stuff up and we're selling fear and all this blah, blah, blah. But that's not how things are. Obviously, business changed. But it's still, to me, an issue that I think plan sponsors should be aware of. Next is some referrals are paid advertising. I've been in the retirement plan business. I know what you know, goes on in the marketplace. When I was, again, when you're an attorney for TPA or affiliated with TPA, you see a lot of things. You don't say anything until, you know, it's collecting the paycheck. But one, you know, task that I do is when somebody asks for a TPA referral, I never give them one TPA. I suggest, you know, talk to two or three people. Let them make the choice. I don't want to be the one, you know, twisting. Years ago, I had a client with a DB issue. They talked to two or three people. The TPA I wanted them to get, they didn't select. They selected somebody else. It is what it is. But, you know, to me, it's really their choice. I don't want anyone to be suggesting that I'm pushing a certain provider. And there are a lot of times that doesn't happen. And, of course, the famous story with my old law firm, I give them a list of people, and of course, they don't hire the people that I recommended. But, you know, we still joke about that. But one aspect of the business that I really don't like, anytime I'm approached by brokers, they'll tell me about this program, what they refer for accountants and attorneys, and if you refer them work, they're going to give you money back. And it's all, you know, it's all supposed to be disclosed and all that, and I get really uncomfortable. It's just to me, I think as an attorney, you're getting paid one way on a legal fee. You should not be paid on a referral fee basis. I don't want to be accused of that I'm selling my referrals for money. And to me, again, I think it's disingenuous. For an attorney or an accountant making one, you know, making money for, you know, through their fee with the client, and then on the opposite end, getting a kickback for, you know, financial assets that they have nothing to do with it. It's to me, it's again, it's like pay to play. Speaking out of school again. I knew, he's since passed away, there was an ERISA attorney in Florida. At one point, he had his own ERISA practice. And then he joined a really well-known national law firm out in Florida. He was upset. He referred work to a friend of mine who was an advisor that was, you know, on side of the TPA. And he didn't get a kickback. And again, years later, he joined that prestigious law firm. And he did create a dummy corporation so he could get his referral fee without letting the partners of his firm know about it. It's just, listen, I you know, I have to go to sleep at night. I don't want to be known that I was the guy who's making money, you know, both ways with the client, even if it's fully disclosed. So many situations where, you know, you just know that these referrals are paid for. And I think plan sponsors really need to be aware that this still happens. Obviously, if somebody's recommending two to three people, the less likely of that there's some sort of kickback. Next, it's really all about the assets. Fees, you know, everything, service, all that kind of stuff. Which providers are available? It's all about the assets. That's why, to this day, there is a plan sponsor that actually it's a TPA that had a situation where they charged a percentage of assets. To me, a TPA charging an asset-based fee doesn't make any sense anymore. It still happens. And, you know, it's important that plan sponsors realize that this stuff goes on, still goes on. Next, a bad TPA will obviously hurt a plan sponsor. Retirement plans, especially 401k plans, have so many working parts. Most errors occur in the day-to-day plan administration, so choosing the right or wrong TPA can certainly help or hurt a plan sponsor. Bad TPAs get plan sponsors into a lot more trouble. you might get promises that they contractually won't deliver. You know, that's always an issue. The limited scope 338 fiduciary to me is one of them. The producing TPA, who in their advisory contract says they're not a fiduciary. It's those things in the contract where they sell you one thing, and when it comes to it, they just don't do it. So that's really the issue at hand that I see. So it's something that, you know, obviously an ERISA attorney reviewing a contract can suffice, you know, can opine as to whether the promises are really going to be there and whether they're really going to be delivered. Obviously, the fiduciary warranty is another example of nonsense where an insurance company will give a warranty that the plan sponsor is going to be limited in their liability in picking the fund lineup. And the broad range of investment requirements is something that plan sponsors never get sued of because you only need a couple of fund choices. So that's part of the nonsense. And, you know, a good buddy of ours once opined that if an insurance company insures risk for money, what does it say about the fiduciary warranties when they give it to a plan sponsor for free? And I told about the years ago that as a insurance company, they tried selling a client of mine their product. I was very much against it. They gave me free Mets tickets, actually for two games, one at the Hyundai Club, and then one on the third baseline. That changed my opinion. Needless to say, about 4 or 5 years later, I don't get any more free tickets. But contracts and warranties and all that kind of stuff have to be read by an ERISA attorney to make sure that what's being promised is actually delivered. Despite it all, last but not least, despite it all, it's all always the plan provider's fault. You know, it's the plan provider's fault, but, you know, the plan sponsor is always the one bearing the risk. So that's an issue that plan sponsors need to realize that, yeah, it's a plan provider's fault, but ultimately the plan sponsor is always going to be the one who's going to pay the piper and the fees and the excise tax and all the things that go wrong with a plan. And, you know, you hear it from these plan sponsors, I didn't know. Well, that's the nature of the game. And even if you hire a 338 advisor, if there's the second coming of Bernie Madoff, plan sponsors still be on the hook for that. So, you know, again, I will always say that eliminating liability is something that can never happen. It is what it is. And I think that that is something that should be talked about and understood, that no matter what, the plan sponsor will always be on the hook. So hope you enjoyed this episode of That 401k Podcast. Go to that 401ksite.com for further information on all our events. And tune in next week for another fun-filled episode of That 401k Podcast. Thanks.